Right. Why don't we go ahead and get started? And as usual, just because we are recording this all for members of the public to listen into, can we have everyone just say their name and who they're with?
Jean Langendar. I'm a governor appointee for the rural area on this one.
Good afternoon. This is Paige McGilloway with the Texas State Affordable Housing Corporation.
Mark Wyatt with Texas Department of Agriculture.
All right. And then there's Elizabeth Yevich, and I are here at the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Elizabeth is eating her lunch.
Hi, everybody.
Well, let's get started with old business. So as you all recall, at our last committee meeting, we went over the QAP. Oh, did we have another person just join? Oh, maybe not. So what happened at our last meeting is we went over the QAP and basically the ways in which housing tax credits are allocated and the different ways in which points are awarded through selection criteria. And so what I tried to do in the document that is titled Housing Committee Recommendations on the Housing Tax Credit Qualified Allocation Plan is that I attempted to break down both the background information that we received from the director of our Housing Tax Credit Program, Cameron Dorsey, and then also provide the recommendations that the council had proposed. So that document was also then submitted to the multifamily division's staff, so that way we could get the perspective of those program administrators, since I know that the feedback that I've received from this committee is we need to have the presence of those who work at PDHCA that are, you know, experts in the different funding sources that we want to talk about to weigh in. So I held a meeting on Monday morning and received that feedback from multifamily staff on the draft recommendations of the committee. And as you can see, we had a lot that we talked about. There was a lot of feedback provided. So I don't know what would be most helpful. Should I go through, based on the recommendation, the feedback that was received? Has everyone read the document? Because if not, I can certainly go through it and summarize.
This is Mark. I think that's probably a good approach. I read it the reverse order, and that was, you know, it's kind of like, that sounds good. And then I read staff's perspective, and it's kind of like, oh, wow. It certainly changes the reality is that, for instance, if no one will select that factor, and it's virtually a non-issue there.
Right. I know what you all wanted to see was, you know, realistically, in terms of the implementation of a council recommendation, what could we possibly foresee as the reaction by those that apply for housing tax credits? And so I think that, you know, we definitely want to, though, continue to actually speak to developers, and that was going to be my next step was also to want to speak to developers that utilize housing tax credits. I did get some of that perspective from the multifamily staff as they work so extensively with those developers. So the first recommendation was the committee had discussed the potential of adding supportive services to the tenant services scoring item within the QAP. The way that the tenant services are currently allocated is that the applicant has the flexibility to choose from a list that's defined in Texas Administrative Code, and there are 20 services that make up the current list that are worth a variety of points from 1 to 4 points per service. And an applicant can receive up to a maximum of 10 points for this item. So I laid out those services which currently are in existence in the Texas Administrative Code and support independent living for persons with disabilities. So those are daily transportation, health and nutritional courses, a pre-approved caseworker for seniors, persons with disabilities, or supportive housing, and then weekly home chore services for seniors and persons with disabilities. So those items are already within the Texas Administrative Code as possibilities. Then what I did is, given the council's recommendation of potentially adding supportive services, I looked at those services which we defined in the 2010-2011 biennial plan and listed those services as possible additions to the list of Hello? Looks like we had somebody maybe put us on hold. so that was the first thing I submitted to our multifamily staff. And then the feedback that I received, which is on the first page of the feedback document, they had some questions back to the committee. The first one was that because the tenant services scoring criteria requires that no fees can be charged to the tenant for these services, that means that the property owner would have to pay for the provision of services or have an agreement with a third party to provide them free of charge. So given that, the staff was asking if the committee, if it was the committee's intention to recommend the provision of services regardless of the tenant's ability to receive those services through another means, such as through their eligibility for a Medicaid waiver or another form of public or private care, and the fact that given that the criteria for all tenants to take advantage of, you know, if somebody chose this service, it would be provided to any individual in the property, not just those tenants that were persons with disabilities that were looking for them. So there was a question there about, is the intention to provide services regardless of the tenant's ability to receive them in other ways? And then there was also the idea that developers would likely see these service options as cost prohibitive and may not elect to choose them even if they were added to the list because of the cost of providing that and paying for that service themselves. So that was the first item.
Well, on that, I think it does make it real difficult because I think clearly housing providers don't want to get into the home health business or anything of that nature. And if it's required that it be paid for by the developer, I don't think that's the model any of us, I don't think, we're looking at. I think it would be more of, and I don't, it's a whole other point structure of having agreements with organizations that provide those services or something of that nature.
Right.
I'm saying,
that was something that we had ventured into in our last biennial plan that maybe we want to reiterate more in detail this time.
Yeah, I mean, some way of making it that there's, you know, actual a partnership, MOU, you know, something very specific that can be shown that the services are going to be provided, but through an outside, not a housing provider.
You know, I agree with that entirely. There's only one thing wrong, and that is it can come back to bite you in the rear because if that service provider suddenly decides not to do it anymore or goes out of business, then the owner is stuck with, I got to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
If there can be some provision of that. Now, the only hook to that is, and I will not accuse my fellow developers of anything, but, you know, I'll get an MOU today and next week I'll cancel it, you know, if that's all I got to do is have one to get credits. So there has to be a hook in there that it is intended to be a long term, and there might be some grace period to provide a substitute if the original service provider, for some reason, backed out of the deal or was unable to continue.
And Mike, thank you for joining us. And in terms of the hook that you're talking about, I totally understand what your point. And I think that multifamily staff brought up that point as well in the next bullet point on that first page, stating that there's a risk of noncompliance with housing tax credit rules, and also a risk of financial solvency for the property if their third-party service partner, who's been providing these services free of cost, backs out at some time during the affordability period. And so what do you think, did you have any possible ideas for what that hook could be?
Well, first of all, I agree with Jean. There needs to be an MOU between the developer and the service provider so that says, I'm going to have these services available, period. And I think in that context, then it could be limited to the special needs, and we'll say transportation. It could be limited to special needs, and you don't have to serve everybody else on the property because it is directed and is by a specific, for a specific group. Whereas if the owner said, well, I'm going to provide transportation, it's going to get stuck with everybody on site that wants to go somewhere. The other would be to give some grace period. If for some reason the partnership is dissolved through no fault of the developer, that they would have 6 months, 7 months, I don't know, to replace a service provider without being in violation of their tax credit agreement. And the only other thing on this subject is the comment was made, I believe, in the document you said, it's about, who's going to lock this up for 15 years? My answer, if you think that's a bad question, what about 30 years? Because every developer out there is going to take the extended use and going to run this thing to 30 years.
Right. I just wanted to point out the compliance period by federal law has to be at least 15, but yes.
And everybody's going to opt for the additional because it gets you more points on the QAP, so they're damn well, I'm going to check it. So you're really talking about a 30-year agreement, unofficially.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so what you're suggesting, you suggested two items. Mm-hmm. One, that that perhaps the way to go about this is separate from the tenant service scoring item, that there be a perhaps a supportive services opportunity where there would be an MOU for those individuals that are special needs population individuals, and that be one thing, and then the second thing being a window of time, a grace period to replace a service provider if a service provider is lost.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the first part.
Okay.
So, as it stands, the only time in which it sounded like from our multifamily staff that our housing providers would be asking about a documentation of a disability would be if that person, if they were setting aside units within their property for a special needs population. So I guess that kind of goes along with the scoring item about targeting populations with special needs then, because that's the only time that we require a documentation of disability. So if we were limiting services just to a special needs population, it could only be those that we had documented, right? Does that make sense?
Yes, as long as you don't restrict it to only the percentage of set aside. If for some reason the property acquires more than X percent of persons with special needs, I think those should also be eligible as long as it's documented that they fall into that category. Now, that's could be problematic, but I'm almost taking the tax credit folks into the realm of HUD, where you tell them that for persons for persons with special needs, we have a memorandum of understanding with so-and-so to provide whatever service it is going to be covered by that. And then you say, if you have this need, please, sign, indicate, or whatever, so that you have a record on intake and you know who they are.
So it would still be a self-identification type?
Self-identification, yeah. Because if they don't self-identify, then they're not eligible for the service. And in many cases, they would have, you know, maybe caseworkers or somebody from one of the local agencies that are already helping them. But if not, you know, you would give them the opportunity to self-identify and qualify. But the owner requirement stops with the advertisement and request, and they do not have an affirmative requirement to go deeper than that in making inquiries.
Okay. Another question that I had that was coming from a compliance monitoring standpoint. If we did recommend some type of MOU with an outside service provider, what I've heard from our compliance staff is that it would not be underneath the guise of complying for housing tax credits to find out if the outside service provider was complying with the MOU. That would be outside the guise of our compliance monitoring. So I don't know if we want to address that right now with this recommendation, but I think that there is that component of how do you make sure that that service provider is being held accountable.
Okay, well, okay, this is Paige. I have a question. And I should probably ask my asset oversight people here in the office. Unfortunately, they're out today. But how, when compliance goes out there, how do they verify that they're doing the other tenant services that they've done? Is it just through looking at documentation? I mean,
I believe there is for the on-site reviews. There is a set of criteria for the current services that are provided. But like we talked about, those services are typically provided by the developer.
Right.
And I think that what, you know, we were talking about is we want to make it so that there is some separation that the housing provider is not the service provider.
Right.
And I think that you get into a gray area given that the compliance monitoring function of TDHCA is compliance with the LORA of the property, and I think that you get into some gray area of how you would then make that, you know, holding an outside service provider that has not received funding from the Texas Department of Housing accountable.
Well,
I don't see that as something we can't get past, though.
I think we can get past. It depends on what kind of services. For example, if it's transportation, you certainly would have a schedule of transportation and be able to document that there were pickups. That's pretty easy. If it were some sort of in-home care, the service provider might be willing to give an annual report that said, you know, we have provided services to the following residents on an as-required basis and get some sort of minimal reporting so that the developer is not trying to find out every time they come on site or they do their thing. But
right.
The service provider generally, I don't think, would have a problem with a light summary report of activity.
And I don't see that being a problem, getting a documentation from the service provider. I'm talking about TDHCA does not have the authority to have recourse if they do not.
Right.
No, you can't do anything against the service provider, but you can sure hit the developer. So it's incumbent on the developer to make sure that these things are being done. If the service provider says, yeah, we signed the MOU, we haven't been out there even though you got people. Well, you know, there's something that doesn't sound right there.
Okay. I think that's something that I can definitely take back to our compliance staff and discuss that more.
Yeah, I would ask them what would they consider the minimum requirement so that they're comfortable that something is happening in that area without being overbearing to the service provider or to the people that are doing the compliance monitoring. You know, what would they be happy with at what level without it being too burdensome?
Okay, thanks, Mike. We'll look into that.
Because don't they go out there once a year, or is it once every 2 years? How does that work, guys?
Yes, there's a set time frame for on-site review. Yes,
yeah, and it's
frequent.
not more than once, I think, a year. So.
No, it's the correct page.
Ashley.
Yes.
Hey, it's Michael Lytle here. I'm a janitor at TDHCA. But I do know a little bit about the
subject. Well, that's for sure.
I do know a little bit about the subject. We actually do on-site reviews really more almost like once every 3 years. And I think Mike probably knows this too. Sometimes it's less depending on if we get specific concerns that have been brought to our attention. There are desk reviews a lot more frequent though in terms of looking at things like income verification and stuff like that. But admittedly, the on-site reviews are usually between once every 2 or 3 years.
Unless we screw it up badly, then they'll probably come back quick.
That's correct, yeah.
Thank you for chiming in. Well, I think that right there shows that maybe we can just brainstorm and think of a way that we could make this kind of thing work.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And I will talk to our compliance staff, and if I can't get an answer that can be written down on paper, I can bring them into the next committee meeting. Because they, there may be some further questions that they have for you guys. Okay, great. Anything else on this particular piece before we move on?
I don't know what we're moving on to, but in looking at your selection criteria on page 2 of 4,
okay,
document.
Yes.
How you propose, you show us what points are already available for different, services, and then you're proposing kind of, I would think, more robust, services that could be included. I just don't know what the difference would be. The three bullets seem to fit in one of the top ones. So I don't know if it's just a matter of maybe assigning more points to those more robust items, services. It would be the difference. What were you thinking there, Ashley?
So you're saying that you feel as though the three supportive service categories that the council would recommend could be rolled into one of the bullet points of what's already provided under tenant services?
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of looks that way. It looks like, the bottom two of the ones that are already established are just very kind of vague, whereas the ones you propose are more robust. I particularly like the more robust ones. If there's not a difference, then that's fine. I still want to see more points assigned to the more robust services. But does anyone else get that? I mean, I see how, the specific personal care services, that to me could be it could be a caseworker providing that, or weekly home chore services. Those seem very similar. So I'm just trying to establish the differences.
Well, I think that if we go the route that Jean and Mike had recommended in terms of taking Instead of putting these robust services under the tenant services scoring item,
uh-huh,
we instead include them in a new scoring item.
Okay.
Could perhaps have it be, like, because I'm thinking that what we want to do is have this partnership opportunity be itself its own scoring item. Is that what I think I heard from others?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that works.
Okay, if that's the case, that's great. That's great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I will make those revisions then, and make this a separate scoring item that try to flush out the MOU and the services that a separate organization could provide, and have them listed in a robust manner like these are. The next item that
let me ask one question included in this, and I will show my ignorance of all the categories that are there. Would it qualify to have someone on staff who, instead of providing these services, would provide services to link persons with disabilities to such services.
Like having an on-site coordinator?
Yeah, like having an on-site coordinator who wouldn't do the services but would have access. And I guess where I'm coming from is, will our population generally already be connected, or would it help them if we had somebody to assist with the connection so that I could get my points by, I'll say, training one of my staff members or two of my staff members who we'll say was a leasing agent, except they had a collateral duty to make sure that they were working with this 5% of my potential population, and, you know, that was one of their primary duties, and they, you know, then you get a log and a record of everything they do. Would that be an appropriate category to go in there?
I think that's a good question for the Housing Committee. Do other members have opinions?
I just think that would be very costly, you know, to have a separate coordinator on site. I don't know if that's going to be feasible.
Well, I was saying it would be a collateral duty of a member that's already there, because I would not see this as taking 8 hours a day. Let's say I've got a 100-unit complex. I've got 5 persons with special needs, and my meeting of that requirement is that my person, upon intake, finds out what they need, assists them with connecting to those services, and then it's sort of their ombudsman if they need help with it, or checks on a, we'll say, a monthly basis. Are you happy? Are you getting what you wanted? Yada, yada, yada. But it's probably, you know, a couple hours a week once they're residents of the property. So I don't see it as overbearing. I see it as something that could be accommodated. You might have trouble on a small property, but you may not have on a large where you generally have 3 people in the office already.
So you would identify somebody on staff, or part of their job description would be of to do service coordination.
To do service coordination.
Yeah.
I think that sounds great.
I know somebody managing to do that, have the money for it. But, of course, what we're going to have is Housing Trust Fund put a whole lot of money aside, just kidding, to help fund some service coordination.
Well, let me tell you right now, for example, on a tax credit property, let's say I get $2,000 a month for resident services as an outside contractor, okay? They pro forma that in their budget. For that $2,000 a month, I provide a person on site that will run after-school programs, or that will run computer literacy programs, that will run some other programs. So there could be some, within the tax credit budget, you could put some dollars in there to pay a partial salary to have this done.
Okay.
My only concern is, and I think this kind of was going to what, well, I'm not going to put any words in anybody's mouth, but, you know, I worry about, like, the developer being a service provider or being responsible for it, because it is not just, it's specialized. You know, and we just want to ensure that individuals with disabilities are receiving the right kind of coordination and care, and I don't know if just anyone can do that on a property. I'm just speaking out of this opinion. I don't know. That would be my only concern with that.
Well, remember, I'm not talking about every developer opting for this option. I'm just putting this is an option, and this is a way to do it.
Okay.
And if I opt to take this for my service points, then I may have an MOU with an agency that will provide somebody X number of hours a week to come work with my special needs organization as a link and a follow-up to those links, not providing services themselves, but just being able to be the link and to follow up and do that kind of cleanup work, so that rather than, and that would be fairly easy to replace as opposed to finding someone who will come in and do the housing chores themselves.
I hear you. Okay.
Well, it's just one option. I threw it out there. I'm not married to it. Please don't get
me. I like your brainstorming. I like it.
Okay. And Mike, just to clarify, were you thinking that this would be underneath the section that we're proposing on the MOU, that would be within that MOU that someone could score points on that item for providing that service provider.
So yeah, your MOU might be with another nonprofit who will provide your casework for you, and for so many dollars a month.
Okay. Okay.
It's my opinion that as long as we're not talking about $7,000, we're talking $1,500, $2,000 a month on 150 unit property, I think that's well within the development budget of a tax credit property.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, the next item that we discussed at our last committee meeting on scoring criteria was the population with special housing needs, and the two recommendations that I heard thrown around were increasing the points for this scoring item to as high as they could be legally, and then also the potential to increase the percentage of set aside units within that scoring item, so setting aside maybe 10% of units rather than 5%, which is how it's currently written. And I was asked to ask multifamily staff how that would work out. So the conversation that I had with multifamily staff around the item, one of the things was that given the immensely competitive nature of this award process, the way that it has been at least the last few cycles, housing tax credit cycles, and is foreseeable for the future, is that every single applicant that was even considered for award had gone after all points possible. So every single point they could possibly get, they applied to score. So in that sense, changing the point value may have little impact because everyone is going to be doing that item anyway. Does that make sense? They're gonna go after every single point that you could possibly get within the QAP. So they're gonna go after the points for populations with special housing needs. So the feedback I got from multifamily staff is that there isn't a development awarded anymore that wouldn't score those points.
What if you had the opportunity to pick either 5 or 10%? And if you pick 5, then you got to pick 5 points up somewhere else. If you pick 10, then you might not have to pick up 5 more somewhere else. And the only reason I'm thinking about this is I'll go to somebody like Jean who may have the ability to use 15%. But if it gave her more points to take the 10, she could take the 10 and easily absorb it into the next property she develops.
Okay.
That's just an idea thrown out there that if you get 2 points if you take 5%, you get 4 points if you take 10.
I see what you're saying.
All right.
I was actually going to get to that piece, the 5% versus 10% set aside. The one piece of feedback I got on that from multifamily staff was that there's been feedback received from property managers that these units are the last to lease up, and so that was why it was considered less desirable to do the 10% rather than 5%, because given that the department requires a minimum 12-month period that these units must be held vacant for a special needs individual, every month they go vacant, the property is losing money.
All right. Well, I'd say that has a little bit to do with marketing, just based on the number of people we are serving through the TBRA program and trying to find.
I knew you'd say that, Jean.
I know. Well, trust me, from experience now, I would be so bold as to go higher now that HUD has determined that for integration purposes, which is somewhere we do need to tackle this, maybe not through this committee, this council, but maybe through the DAW, HUD has now determined that 25%. I mean, if you're looking at the new HUD 811, 25% is considered integrated. So before, or as TDHA currently has, percentages which were developed by a group of us back in the day of trying to line it up with the percent of people with disabilities, yada, yada, at the time. But HUD has now clearly taken the lead, and we have a percentage of 25 as the max, or as some magic number, that I think we might even look at going somewhat higher.
Okay, so would that be then that the scoring criteria would say if they set aside 25% of units, or would it be maybe like a gradient like Mike was saying,
gradient.
A gradient, okay.
Yeah.
A gradient, okay.
And while I agree with what Jean says, I also on the practical side disagree in that the number of 25% properties is going to be very low based on the number of vouchers you get. So how many vouchers are we going to get in Texas for this new 811?
No, I agree. That's all yet to be seen, but it's 25% that is going to be allowable. Granted, if we get 25 vouchers, well, how are we going to do that? You know, that's what I'm saying.
A 200-unit property, you're not going to get 50 vouchers, I don't think, mm-hmm. unless you eat up most of the vouchers that Texas is going to get. So those vouchers will go very quickly, in my opinion, particularly if we're not going to develop any more 811s.
Okay. Well, I think we're getting into separate territory here. Because Section 811, you know, that's, I think that is a worthwhile conversation, and that's a conversation that we continue to have as we hopefully will receive a notice of funding availability from HUD on that program. But and we can certainly make recommendations about Section 811 if we want to. I think that this conversation is more about simply setting aside units for persons with disabilities within housing tax credit properties. It doesn't, this point scoring item does not include any rental subsidy component to it at this time. So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to make a recommendation just on the potential set aside of units. Is that correct?
Yes, I would go higher.
And particularly since once those 25 vouchers are gone, you're not going to get them. You're not going to get new vouchers every year. You're going to get funding for X number every year. So. As much as I'd like to support Gene on going to 25%, I don't think it's practical.
Well, this 25%, just Mike, to clarify, I think we may be miscommunicating here. She's just talking about the set aside of units. It has nothing to do with how subsidized those units are.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. But the 25% came from, I believe, from the 811 program where they're going to give you up to 25% of your units with vouchers for persons with special needs.
So the Melville Act.
What I'm saying is you're right. They're two completely different subjects. And
right.
By going to 25% in the QAP, I think we're going to put a number out there that very few people will look at. Because they're not going to take them without some way to pay the rent.
So you basically just don't think that the 25% set aside points would be utilized by developers
not in the tax credit application process. Unless I'll go back to, and this is where it sounds like I'm picking on Gene, but I mean that's her specialty. And so if she were going to develop a property, that might be a can-do easy. But you know, but for Harry Schmeltz out of El Paso, he may not be able to do anything with it. So it's just
Okay.
Be a little bit out of the ballpark from where we are.
Okay.
A little too aggressive.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. We still can provide a gradient opportunity. And Jean, in terms of you were talking about the integrated housing rule. I think it is a conversation for the Disability Advisory Work Group, but I also think that it's not outside the realm of what this Housing Committee can make recommendations on if you so choose.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think because we did have a lot of testimony, and I have had testimony about it.
Right.
Now that HUD has given us some guidance, which before we just had to rely on what was put together and I think Michael Lytle might be one of the people that was around way back then, but it was, it came out of a committee, but it came out because there was no federal guidance at the time of what integration meant, and we did it based on, again, looking at population with Ann Denton, who was a wizard doing that kind of stuff at the time.
Yeah, Gene's right. I mean, we did create literally something out of nothing at that point.
Yeah. Kind of pulled it out of the air, but we used the population numbers is
right.
What we used. But those have all changed, and so I'm just saying now that HUD has given us an opportunity, I think we ought to try to take that as motivation to open this up with some federal guidance. I think hopefully, of course, in Texas, federal guidance usually goes out the window, but we can use it and maybe come up with something that is a little easier for the department if you look at 25% max kind of thing rather than the two-tiered stuff that we had before. So I'm not sure where it would go here. I don't know that we have a place, but we might add to it or something.
And I think that, yeah, I mean, you're right. I think that if it was a recommendation on the integrated housing rule, it would be itself a separate recommendation than the QAP, but that I can't craft something.
I think we ought to try it.
Okay.
Now's the time. I was hoping the 811 stuff would come out with some guidance, but it seems to be dragging. So we.
It does.
Yeah. I mean, they've provided enough to say 25%. So.
Yes. Well, and for everyone's benefit, just your knowledge, I think we have always intended that at our quarterly council meetings there will be an update on the progress of the CMS grant and grant activities, which includes the application for Section 811 funding. So as much as we can find out by our March 5th meeting, we will provide to you guys.
Yeah, the NOPA is going to be issued in December.
That's right, December.
2011, right?
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Ashley, I need just some basic education before we move forward, because I definitely support having a gradient in there up to the 25%. We need to be supportive and encouraging that kind of work. But just to get back to this point thing, because when I first read through this, I was a little bit confused. So what you're telling me is that if everyone gets the points, and it doesn't matter how many points you assign, you're saying that all tax credits development have special needs housing then?
My understanding from Cameron Dorsey is that at least in the last, I don't know how far back he was going. He said in the last few years that yes, every single awarded application for proposed development had gone after and was awarded all points. So yes.
So now the reason why they do that, I'm guessing, because I don't. Is that they only have to have this window of 12 months, and after that they can give it to anybody. Is that the way or what?
So you're thinking that maybe they see that as they're out from actually providing those units?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I'm asking the question. I just want to understand, because if every deal is really having to set aside 5% of the units for populations with special needs, that's awesome. But it doesn't seem to be that. Doesn't seem to be the case.
Okay, so I can see from our compliance staff, because that would be a question for them, to see if there is data that I can pull as to once the 12-month period is over, if they have any information on. The collecting, I'm sure they have to have information on collecting who's using those units. I can bring that to the compliance staff.
Because I don't know if anyone else is confused by this, but then I was looking at you give us some great stats on the 2012 competitive log.
Oh, that was for the set-aside criteria, yes.
Yeah, and so it just seems like, yeah, not all of these are doing that. I mean, so I'm just confused.
What do you mean not all of these are doing that?
Well, I mean, it says of the 72 of the 388 applications are for are applying under the nonprofit set aside, and only 4 of the 72 are identified as supportive housing under targeted population.
Right. So support. I just want to make sure we all understand. I define it in the paragraph below those stats. So supportive housing is separate.
Okay.
Than the scoring criteria for setting aside units for special needs populations.
Okay, so what the heck then is populations with special housing needs?
The way that it's defined in the QAP is all of those populations which are defined in statute as requiring priority by the agency. So that includes persons with disabilities, the elderly, it includes veterans, youth aging out of foster care, farm workers.
There's another one. But that group.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
That's defined, I believe, by statute or by Texas Administrative Code, one or the other.
Okay. So, I mean, really they could be doing veterans and
they could be. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, so that, to me, it doesn't really help, but, because I think these developers are not really hitting the target population that we here as a council are striving to serve.
Okay, so that scoring item.
You understand what I'm trying to get at here?
I think you're saying that they could utilize those 5% units for a different population than persons with disabilities.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. I do. I don't, at this time, I should check with Cameron to see if applicants, when they are trying to score those points, if they specify which special need they're basically affirmatively marketing to.
Yeah.
I can ask that question of Cameron.
Yeah, I'd be interested because I could rent my wife out.
Okay, let's see. Okay, so I will, bring that point back. The next discussion was on the set-aside criteria, and as Paige mentioned, I provided what was in the pre-application submission log, because I was trying to see one of the questions you all asked at the last committee meeting was, if we put a specific priority within the nonprofit set aside for supportive housing, would we actually be achieving what we wanted to achieve? Are the people who are doing supportive housing, are they nonprofit organizations? And so I was trying to get to that by my review of the pre-application logs, and it seems to me, the thing is, we're only looking at 5% of all pre-applications, sorry, it's not 5%, 5 applications of all 388 pre-applications, so 1.3% are identifying themselves as supportive housing. But 4 out of 5 of those are nonprofit organizations. So it's a small group that are identifying themselves as supportive housing that are going after this funding source, but of those, the majority are nonprofits. So that may lend some leverage to a recommendation of prioritizing the nonprofit set aside to supportive housing. Does anyone have any further comments on that?
I found the stats not what I expected them to be, is all. It's interesting. Up to 72 in the 388 of the nonprofit set aside, you break it down further by the targeted population for supportive housing and elderly housing.
Mm-hmm.
Are the 4 that are supportive housing, are they included in the 24, or could they, or are they separate and distinct?
The 4 that are supportive housing are separate and distinct from the 21 that are elderly housing.
Okay.
Does the council or the committee still believe that a possible recommendation should be the prioritization of supportive housing developments within the nonprofit set aside?
Yes.
This Mark, I think a set aside is the is probably the surest way to get those awarded. I mean, depending on as opposed to some of the other options we've been talking about. Certainly, anytime you have a set aside, people are going to gravitate to that because they recognize it really doesn't matter what score you get on some of these factors. You're going to rise into the selection realm. So basically, it's the easiest way to ensure that a significantly larger percentage get funded. I don't know how popular it would be, but I know from program design, it's the surest way of making the percentage increase.
Ashley?
Yes.
This is Michael Lytle. I can tell you that would be the least popular solution. That could be forwarded. I mean, in terms of the general acceptance factor, set asides are in the tax credit program, as Gene knows and others, has been frowned upon strongly by leadership at the Capitol and Governor's office for a while. I'm not saying it's not worth including in the recommendation, but I'm just saying that once it gets out of this committee and out of the council, you know, you're going to run into a lot of resistance, that's all.
I mean, I think that's a really valid point. And I think that, and just to clarify, we're not recommending a entirely new set-aside. We're recommending a prioritization within an existing set-aside. But I completely understand your point, Michael.
Yeah. Anyhow, that's all I wanted to mention.
Okay. All right. And then the last recommendation that we talked about was just about making sure that our multifamily staff, when they are looking for public input during the QAP creation process, to do more to outreach to the disability community and those organizations which could provide feedback. I provided just the general timeline for when the QAP undergoes its revision process. And so this is just giving you guys the recommendation that I heard at the last meeting was that we need more individuals that are advocating for housing tax credits to be used to serve persons with disabilities to be participating in the QAP creation process and providing their input along the way. But that one, I mean, that one, I don't think there really is any problem with. I think multifamily staff has no problem with doing a further outreach efforts. So that one I didn't have any feedback on from the multifamily staff.
We ought to have a bullet in that on our website or our clearinghouse.
What do you mean by bullet? Sorry, what do you mean by that?
That we should have something in there, whether it be a pop-up when you sign on or something that talks about the QAP comment period for persons interested in pushing for service-oriented housing. You know, here's your chance to comment on the upcoming cycle of awarding of tax credits to such developers, or to developers to encourage them to use. That's kind of an off the wall thing when we're sitting here talking about outreach. If our web our clearinghouse is used properly, putting something up there to tell the people that access it to find out what's available might get more participation by people serving the disability population.
Okay, that's something that we can pass on to the 811 team.
Well, that's tomorrow, isn't it? I
forgot. Yes, and for those of you just that know what Mike was talking about, he was talking about the online clearinghouse that the CMS grant money is going toward to creating. Okay, I will. Yes, I will provide that feedback. And finally, just a final thing, there were two items that the multifamily staff discussed that didn't pertain to any one recommendation made by the committee, but were more general comments on potential avenues to further research or make recommendations on. The first one was around the issue of affordability. Basically the feedback that I received, which is given the fact that that one of the main barriers for persons with disabilities when attempting to rent housing tax credit units is their low level of income, below 30% of area median income, there has to be some type of way of providing a form of rental assistance to that population in order for the property to be able to provide that unit. Basically, this is something we've already talked about, but that financially the developer cannot provide that large of a subsidy on their own without becoming insolvent. So that's why the multifamily staff was talking about ways in which the council can make recommendations on outside forms of rental assistance being partnered. And so one thing that they talked about was that every public housing authority in the state has Section 8 voucher allocation, and that Section 8 vouchers can be project-based. So they typically are all tenant-based, but a portion of your tenant-based vouchers can be project-based and utilized for a particular housing property. And so that was something that they were basically just saying to the committee could possibly look into further. That's the first item. I don't know if anyone has any feedback on that one.
If most housing authorities, if I'm not mistaken, have a waiting list for their vouchers, and if you start taking those vouchers away and giving them to somebody else, you're going to exacerbate the lack of affordable housing, in at least in the metropolitan areas.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's a great idea, but the reality out there is nobody has any vouchers to even open up their list.
You know, an alternative might be to go and set the rent at 30% of area median based on family size. Now, that would still be a pretty deep subsidy, but it would mean that, you know, I don't know, I'd have to look at what that does on a pro forma. I know in Bayer County and probably in Travis as well, that would be a reasonable rent. Wouldn't be the market rent, but it would, you know, would be a fair amount.
Sorry, Mike, I may have not heard the first part of that. Could you explain what were you saying about the 30%?
You instead of your rent would not be 30% of the applicant's income. It would be your rent on that unit would be set at 30% of the median area income. Based on the size of the family that's applying or the household that's applying. So, you know, if you got one person applying for their property, then the rent on the unit's $350. If you got two people, maybe it's $450. How they come up with it's theirs. But, you know, it may mean that they pay more than 30% of their available income for rent, but it gives them a skewed rent that would help them out.
Okay, well, I mean, I think
to see what that number would be, I would admit that.
Yeah, I just want to point out that that would be going against HUD guidance in terms of, I think one of their biggest concerns is when folks are cost burdened. So I don't, you know, I mean, it's an option. I just don't know if it's an option that would receive a lot of positive feedback. Okay. Second item that the multifamily staff discussed was that another potential barrier for people with disabilities is accessibility, that we all know that. And we know that the federal guideline, what that guideline is for making units accessible.
Ashley, on that, could we, if we're going to have this as a document where it says federal guidelines require, if you would put federal guidelines adopted by the state to require that, because federal guidelines actually don't require housing tax credits to have to go with 504. This is something the state has adopted in law based on.
Right. Sorry about that.
So, no, I just want to be clear because a lot of people think that's coming from the feds, and it's. I mean, I don't want to give anybody an option to take it away, but the reality is, it was something the state legislature did all by itself.
Right. Okay. Yes. So the guidelines that adopted by the state to require the 5% units accessible for persons with physical impairments and 2% for hearing or vision. And the multifamily staff just put out there that this doesn't preclude an increase in the percentage of those units that are made accessible, and the potential for that recommendation on incentivizing accessibility for a greater portion of units. So that was another basically discussion that they had that they wanted to provide back to the committee. Is there any thoughts about that as a recommendation?
Would it be incentive-wise? I mean, point-wise? Try to put points in? Or
it would be, yeah, I guess to us, but it could be.
I mean, I think that's what they'd have to have. I guess the department could actually do a threshold and go higher than what the legislature said, but... If Michael Lido's still on the phone, that doesn't often go very well.
Yeah. While in theory, it's a good idea. Yeah, Gene's right about that.
So you're saying that it would be unpopular to have scoring criteria that award points for a greater percentage of accessible units?
No, I'm saying as a threshold.
As a threshold.
Awarding points would be, I mean, it's going to be more points into the mix, but I'm just saying, because I had said perhaps PDHCA would want to put it in as a higher threshold than what's in state law.
I see.
Yeah, and that's where I said I don't think that would probably be wise, but if you add more points and they can choose to do it instead of a threshold, well, that has some interest.
Wouldn't we be kicking ourselves in the foot if we didn't increase it, if we're increasing the number of units set aside for persons with special needs?
No, you're correct there. I mean, you could, but there's so many people with disabilities that don't need those features necessarily, but, you know, have other disabilities.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Then I get that.
Yeah.
But I see your point, Paige, that if there's a recommendation to provide the potential to get extra points by set aside a greater number of units for special needs, then yeah, it makes sense that this would be a kind of a companion. I mean, makes sense to do. okay. Okay. Great. Great. The last thing on this document was...
Can I interject one on that one? You can make it more palatable if you make the second 5% adaptable, which means they may not be accessible 100% of the time, but they can easily be modified if somebody comes in, because all of the switches and all that are already taken care of. All you would really have to do would be have a removable cabinet. Because your turning radius and all that's already taken care of under the Fair Housing Act for anything that's newly constructed.
Okay.
That's just a comment.
Okay. Okay. So the last thing on this document, in terms of the discussion that I had with multifamily staff, is that, you know, my question to them was, given that we have a scoring criteria about the rent level of units that provides points to those who set aside units for households at 30% of area median income or below, would it be possible to hold those units open for specifically for persons with disabilities that meet that income threshold first before opening that up to the general population that is at 30% or below? And so I put that out there as another possible option, and the only thing that they said was that they've heard from property managers that there's a very high demand for the units at 30% of AMI. Those units are typically the first to be leased up, so the potential of holding open the units for persons with disabilities, the only consequence is that if those units remain vacant, that the property is losing money. And that was the same thing that I had mentioned before about units being held vacant means the property loses money. So that, therefore, it's sometimes an unpopular decision.
I thought this was very interesting because, as you said, and you brought this up before, earlier in the document, and why are we having a difficult time leasing up the units that are set aside for special, what are we calling it? I need to make sure I get the terms right.
It's called special needs population.
Yeah, special housing needs, yeah. What's the issue there? Do we know? Can we make any assumptions?
Marketing.
Yeah, what Mike said, and I know, you know, I teased Jean earlier about this, but I think Jean's right too. I think it's a lack of or not nearly enough marketing and outreach.
So the apartment complexes need to do it, or who should be doing that?
Well, so we do have a requirement to market to the population. Perhaps it's about being more specific or increasing what the requirements are within that marketing requirement.
Yeah, because I just don't get that. I don't know why that's a problem.
I can certainly bring back that question to get further feedback.
Yeah, I think the answer is in general, if I'm leasing up a new property, I've got locators, real page, and apartments.com all over my property, and I've got balloons hung every 2 feet. But I'm not going down to the disability services people and saying, hey, I've got 5 units out here. You got any clients?
And why is that?
I would say oversight. I would say in general with the go-go attitude of new lease-ups, you're trying to get as many people in as possible for as few bucks as possible, and you're hitting the places that will give you the highest amount of traffic.
Okay.
And it's oversight. It's, you know, it's just nobody thinks about it.
I appreciate that perspective, Mike.
And maybe that's something that the other committee can think about too, you know, as far as how we can tie maybe the service providers in with, you know, developers somehow in that marketing push.
Okay. Yeah, that's something that we can bring up with them. And of course, I'll see if I can get further clarification about particulars of the marketing plan that is required of developers, but also feedback that we've received as to why they're not leasing up the units.
Yeah. It used to be called the Affirmative Fair Housing Marketing Plan.
Okay.
And it required you to have community contacts and show that you contacted them.
Okay. All right. Great. Is there any other feedback on what the items that are being discussed about the qualified allocation plan?
No, I think you did a really great job of summarizing what we talked about on the last call and bringing it kind of to some fruition on black and white. And I really appreciate you talking with TDHCA staff and trying to brainstorm.
Thank you. I will continue to do so since I know that we definitely want to have the presence of our program administrators in this process. And as much as I can, I will try to touch base with them after each of these meetings to relay the opinions of the committee and also the questions of the committee. Okay, great. The last thing before we end is I just wanted to real quickly give you guys a feedback or hear your feedback. I'm sorry about the draft outline for the 2012-2013 plan. I realize now that I'm looking at it, the front page has a incorrect date on it. Okay. I wanted to give you basically what the framework that I drafted for the plan would be. So what the chapters headings would be, and then I provided basically on each page that is the chapter a couple of bullet points as to what could be included in that chapter. And I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything, if you guys have anything to add, or if there were things that you didn't feel like needed to be in this plan, I also wanted to hear that. So did anyone have any feedback on the framework of the plan?
No, Ashley, I do not.
Okay, anyone else?
I'm looking at it now really quickly. I printed the whole thing out and went, oh my gosh, there's a lot of blank pages. But the whole idea is, yeah. I mean, it's similar to what
we did before, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, you know, hopefully maybe familiarize them with the way we do things. I don't know. But
well, I think that what this one has a little bit more of is, given the last time it was we started the council and then it was rush to put out a plan,
mm-hmm.
and this time we've had a little bit more time to do research, to get feedback. You know, we did our local capacity, our provider capacity survey, and got a lot of good data out of that. And I think we should provide that.
Right.
We got a lot of good stuff from the case studies that we did with service-enriched housing providers around the state about their financial models, and we can provide that. And then also we obviously have this ongoing CMS grant and potential Section 811 that I think that is going to be kind of our guinea pig in terms of making this happen, making service-enriched housing happen. So I think that hopefully this plan will have more meat in terms of research that was conducted over the interim time frame. And also I think that our recommendations sound like they're going to be much more specific than they were in the past. So I think that's a great thing. I think these are all, I think that the council, that the, especially the governor appointees who are allowed to go and advocate in front of the legislature and our governor can hopefully use this as a tool to do so.
I think it's good.
Thanks.
We'll fill in the blanks.
All right. Okay, then the last thing before you all go is by Friday, I'm giving myself that deadline, by Friday I'm going to have to you a draft of Chapter 1 of the plan that you all can provide feedback as you see fit. The Chapter 1 is going to be the history of the council and includes all of our recommendations made in the last plan and any action steps that have been taken by the federal government, the state legislature, or internally by the state agencies on any of those recommendations. So that's going to be Chapter 1, and I'm going to have a draft to you by Friday on that. And then our next committee meeting is February 22nd. And I will continue to receive feedback from TDHCA staff on what we've talked about today. Are there any outstanding items for the February 22nd meeting that people have a yearning desire to hear about?
What meeting? Is that just the committee meeting on the 22nd?
That's just the committee meeting.
Okay. I may not be able to participate just because
okay.
we're having a monitoring visit by TDHCA.
So enthusiastic, Jean.
Yes, thank you. Gosh, I should have used that as an excuse. Didn't work. No.
Okay.
Anyways, yeah. And if I'm available, I will be on the phone, but I have a feeling we're going to be at one of the 15 houses that they want to go to. So.
Your participation in this group doesn't get you a bye?
I wish it did. I wish they could just say, bless you, Easter Seals, but they don't.
Well,
This is Paige. I'll also, on that day, I will be available. I mean, if we do it from 2 to 3, I'll be available, but I'm going to have to leave the office for another appointment.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to get off the call at 3.
Okay. Why don't we make that a shorter one then, and try not to pack you guys full of stuff on that one. We'll make it a shorter meeting.
Thanks.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.